So actually the one that should be given this talk was Maria Rosa Costanzo, but she had a commitment elsewhere. So she asked me to discuss with you these data, which are probably very well known. So I will go very fast, and I will spend a little more time at the end of my talk in discussing the CARES-HF trial. So why ultrafiltration for the cardiorenal syndrome? The cardiorenal syndrome is what we, the term we use to define a situation where there is an impairment of the heart and of the kidney. The two organs are talking to each other. And if some dysfunction of one or the other is ongoing, the other organ is affected as well. What is the dimension of the problem? The dimension is a large one because acute cardiorenal syndrome occurs in approximately one-third of the patients with acute decompensated heart failure and is associated with a poor prognosis. It's due to multiple processes, and ourselves as physicians play a major role in that when we give excessive treatment with diuretics, which may contribute to worsening renal function. And after the onset of worsened renal function, they may contribute to induce further renal injury. And the acute cardiorenal syndrome are a well-known cause of resistance to medical treatment, and for this reason, current treatment guidelines state that ultrafiltration is a reasonable approach in patients with congestion who do not respond to medical treatment with the class 2A level of evidence B, and I will return to that. So what is ultrafiltration? Ultrafiltration is a process whereby plasma water is produced from all blood by filtration through a semi-permeable membrane in response to a transmembrane pressure gradient. The ultrafiltrate contains crystalloids but not cells or colloids, and the size of the pore allows filtration of molecules up to a size of 65 kilodaltons, and that's very important for what I will say toward the end of my talk. So ultrafiltration can remove fluid from blood at the same rate that fluid can be naturally recruited from the third space, and this is what is going to happen. You remove fluid, and then this transient removal is accompanied by a compensatory mechanism called plasma refill, aim at minimizing this reduction. So what the early studies on ultrafiltration told us? They were in general small size studies, retrospective or observational, basically all uncontrolled. The background therapies were not inclusive of contemporary neurohumoral blockade. There were higher variable diuretic types, dosages, way of administration, and protocol. And a very variable protocol for use of ultrafiltration. There was an inconsistent definition of resistance to diuretics, variable measures to assess response to therapy. Renal function assessment was mostly not done, and a short follow-up period. The duration of extracorporeal fluid removal ranged from single few-hour treatment to daily therapy, repeated over a prolonged period of time. There were different pumps, membranes, and types of therapy, and very different flow rates in the machine, and which allowed a different fluid removal rate. Most of the studies were done with hemofiltration, which is a clearly different method as compared to the one that is available and was assessed in the CARES-HF trial. So what are the lessons that were learned from those early studies? First, the lesson was that the technique allowed a substantial removal of fluid with improvement of congestion and allowed use of lower diuretic doses, in a sense restoring response to diuretic. And also a very important lesson was that an overly aggressive fluid removal converted non-oliguric renal dysfunction to oliguric renal failure, mainly through two mechanisms. The first, a decrease in renal perfusion pressure, and the second, an increase in neurohormonal activation, as I will show you with some data from Italy at the end of the talk. The ultrafiltration technique that we have today is called Venovenous because it uses a catheter inserted in a peripheral midline or central vein for the access, for the input and the output of the blood. But I would like to draw your attention to the fact that the blood flow, which is adjustable, is much lower than those than the blood flows used for conventional hemofiltration. And of course, due to the use of venous catheter which had to stay in place for hours, the use of heparin was mandatory. So the first trial that proved, in a sense, the efficacy of the technique was and the safety of the technique was the SAFE trial, which was published in 2003, showing that according to the number of ultrafiltration sessions undertaking, the amount of fluid removed could be increased, and that was associated with no major changes in the hemodynamic parameters. After that, the first study on early ultrafiltration was Maria Rosa. The primary endpoint of this study, which was called Euphoria, was an efficacy endpoint and a safety endpoint. The efficacy was resolution of congestion within 3 days, allowing early discharge of the patients. The safety endpoint was the feasibility of achieving the primary objective without symptomatic hypotension. Can you go to the next slide? This is not okay. So the patient population was made of elderly people, predominantly male Caucasians, with a 75% ischemic etiology, a very low ejection fraction, and the results were the possibility of performing 2.6 ultrafiltration session with a volume remove of around 8.6 liters, although with a very wide variation from one patient to another. And this was associated with a median hospital stay of around 3 days, which was really interesting in terms of reduction of cost for hospitalization, and was associated basically with an increase in sodium, in serum sodium, whereas in the control group there was not this change. So in summary, the falling weight was significant, and interestingly enough, it was maintained at 30 days and 90 days after discharge, and the BNP values were decreased at 30 days and at discharge significantly. The improvement in the NIH functional class was again improved, although not significantly, and apparently maintained up to 90 days. So after that trial, can you go to the next slide? The conclusion were, therefore, that an initial treatment with ultrafiltration in patients with volume overload and evidence of diuretic resistance resulted in reduced length of stay and improved clinical status. The improvement in clinical status apparently was preserved after discharge up to 90 days, and therefore according to the investigators, there was no clinical justification for reserving ultrafiltration only to patients with diuretic resistance, which is a very strong statement at this point. In fact, the experience from the Mayo Clinic on a very small series of patients, basically at the same time, patients who had a serum creatinine at baseline of 2.2 and an estimated GFR of 38 was associated clearly with worsening of renal function in a proportion of the patients, so that a few of them require dialysis, and the 6 months mortality rate was 55%. So the conclusion up to that to then was that peripheral ultrafiltration safely but in a variable way removed fluids, and in this very high risk population of patients with advanced heart failure, about 45% had a worsening of renal function leading to renal replacement therapy need. So after that, another trial from the same investigators, first author of the CARES trial, a multi-center trial in a small group of patients. Sorry, I need to go back. Seven centers, 40 patients, 20 per arm, hospitalized for acute decompensated heart failure, a single ultrafiltration intervention, artificially constrained to 8 hours, and no titration of the therapy against clinical or biochemical sign of congestion. And the results in terms of fluid removal was clear-cut. There was a decrease in the an increase in the ultrafiltration group, which was borderline significant. So that the conclusion at that time from the same investigators of the CARES trial was that ultrafiltration is the gold standard for salt and water removal, is safe in a variety of clinical sites with no reported adverse events. Ultrafiltration delivers a predictable clinical response, and therefore there is no clinical justification to delay ultrafiltration therapy until diuretics fail. And then came UNLOAD, again a study from Maria Rosa in patients with acute decompensated congestive heart failure with to test the following hypothesis. In these patients, ultrafiltration is superior to aggressive IV diuretic therapy in reducing volume overload? Is it associated with sustained clinical benefits? Is similar to IV diuretics in terms of safety? So this is basically the design of the study. I'll go fast. The efficacy endpoint was the weight loss at 48 hours and the dyspnea score. The safety was a change in a number of parameters of renal function and electrolytes and episodes of hypotension to make. And then there were a number of secondary endpoints, including which were pre-specified, including a number of endpoints that had to do with rehospitalization, rate of patient rehospitalized, absolute number, and days of rehospitalization. The results are well known, so can you move to the next slide, please? The inclusion criteria were basically standard. Next slide. The weight loss, the primary endpoint of weight loss was met. The ultrafiltration was more effective than the standard care. However, the dyspnea score was not significantly different, despite the fact that there was clearly a higher net fluid loss in the ultrafiltration arm than in the usual care arm. And of note, the only adverse event which was more significant was bleeding, clearly related to heparin treatment, whereas creatinine tended to be higher at 72 hours, but not significantly so. between the ultrafiltration and the standard care arm. There were no clinically significant differences at each assessment interval in BUN, electrolyte, bicarbonate. Serum potassium less than 3.5 occurred in 1% of the patients in the ultrafiltration group and 12% of the patients in the standard care group, which was significant from the statistical standpoint, and episodes of hypotension were similar as well. And the fact that potassium went up is because in the diuretic group, the potassium excretion was much higher. But I would like to draw your attention to an interesting finding, and that was that sodium excretion increase in the ultrafiltration arm, suggesting that in a sense, ultrafiltration was restoring the ability of the kidney to eliminate sodium and therefore to correct fluid excess, not only by removal of water, but also of sodium through the kidney. The secondary endpoint also showed similar improvement, and interestingly, there was a difference between the ultrafiltration arm and the standard care arm in terms of hospitalization at 90 days. Which was borderline significant. And therefore, the conclusions from UNLOAD were that early ultrafiltration produces greater weight loss than IV diuretic without changes in renal function. An early ultrafiltration strategy reduces 90 days the number of hospitalization and the number of days in the hospital. And for this reason, the guidelines recommended the use of, stated that ultrafiltration can be reasonable in patients with refractory congestion, not responding to medical treatment, class recommendation 2A, level of evidence B, and basically was this was incorporated also in the European Society of Cardiology guidelines. So after that, AVOID. AVOID is still ongoing. It's a much larger study, planning to enroll about 400 patients per arm, multi-site study in the U.S., where the target population is basically the same, and patients will be followed every 30 days from index hospitalization for heart failure to test the hypothesis that emerged from UNLOAD. So this is the way ultrafiltration is done today with the Y catheter, double lumen, which can be inserted peripherally or in a central vein. This is the system, and in the system, the most important thing, and I would like to draw your attention to this, is the fact that there is a sensor which allows to monitor in real time the changes in hematocrit. And this is very important because according to this study, which I mentioned early, by measuring the changes in hematocrit, you can monitor what's happening to plasma volume, shown up here. And when you start to have a decrease in plasma refilling rate, which can be estimated from this formula down here, you are in trouble because you are causing hypovolemia, and thereby you are close to probably induce worsening of renal function. And whenever you cause hypovolemia, you get neurohormonal activation, as shown here. When your body weight goes down, this was a comparison between furosemide and hemofiltration, you get a stimulation in plasma renin activity. So now CARES. CARES has already been presented, so I think I will go very fast. I would like only just to remind that CARES enrolled patients with cardiorenal syndrome after hospitalization or pre-hospitalization. They didn't have to have a serum creatinine higher than 3.5 or indication to hemodialysis. The ultrafiltration, according to the protocol, was performed at a fixed fluid removal rate of 200 cc per hour. The addition of vasodilators or inotropic agents after randomization was prohibited in the patients in the ultrafiltration arm unless considered necessary as rescue therapy, whereas it was allowed in the medical treatment arm. Investigators in the medical treatment arm were encouraged to change their dose of diuretics in order to maintain a urine output between 3.5 and 5 liters per day, and the recommendation of on the use of IV vasodilator and inotropic patients were also given and were based on individual blood pressure, ejection fraction, and right ventricular function at 48 hours, but only in the medical treatment arm. Here is the stepped pharmacologic algorithm, which was a very detailed one. I asked Alice before if this is real practice in the United States, and probably this should be real practice everywhere in the world after CARES. The primary endpoint, you have already heard about it, was a bivariate endpoint, the change in serum creatinine and body weight at 96 hours, and then there were a number of secondary endpoints. So let's take a closer look to the component of the bivariate endpoint. As you can see here, there was an increase in serum creatinine, which was 0.23 milligram per DL at 96 hours, and a small decrease in the conventional treatment arm. The change in body weight was the same, but look at what happened at 30 days and at 60 days. Serum creatinine was back to baseline values, so this is something occurring transiently during ultrafiltration and not having a major impact on renal function afterward. And thereby, you see, you've already seen this slide. This is the change in the bivariate endpoint. These ellipses are the 95 confidence interval for the bivariate endpoint. And the conclusion of the investigators was the change in the bivariate endpoint was significant, P0.003, owing primarily to an increase in the creatinine level in the ultrafiltration group. But look at the change in body weight from here to here. It was almost identical. So I would say my conclusion out of those data would be that the change in the primary endpoint was exclusively due to a small change in serum creatinine, which was totally irrelevant from the clinical standpoint. And I would like to hear from our colleague nephrologist what the consideration would be. And then let's look at the study design. Were the investigators able to do a balanced or unbalanced study? Okay, let's take a look at the proportion of those with ischemia as cause of heart failure. 51% in the medical therapy arm, 70% in the ultrafiltration arm. Clearly a highly significant difference, but not just that. The patient had, in the ultrafiltration arm, had a lower ejection fraction, had more atrial fibrillation and flutter, had a lower body weight, which brings us to the hypothesis of a reverse causation, and had a higher NT-proBNP by about 25%. So is this a balanced study design? I don't know. And let's look at the complications then. You have here the complications which led the Data Safety Monitoring Committee to stop the trial beforehand. And as you can see here, electrolyte disorders were seen only in the pharmacologic therapy group, and the other complications, pneumonia and sepsis, were clearly, I wonder, if they were in fact related to ultrafiltration or to the fact that these patients were sicker. And then another point, the rate of fluid removal was mandated to be the same, 200 cc per hour in all patients with ultrafiltration, which may be far too fast for patients with lower blood pressure and or right ventricular dysfunction, because it might have resulted in worsening of renal function due to intravascular volume depletion, because these patients are particularly prone to this type of problems. And in the trial, there is no information on the incidence and severity of right ventricular dysfunction. And it would be fair to make a comparison of the two treatment strategies by removing the same amount of fluid removal, although I admit that this could be difficult to accomplish. And therefore, because of this excessive fluid removal, it's not surprising that ultrafiltration was associated with worsening of renal function. And as I said, contemporary devices are equipped with the hematocrit sensor for the estimation of blood volume, and therefore the speed of the fluid removal with ultrafiltration should be monitored in this way. And then there was the problem of treatment, which I already mentioned. But besides that, there were additional problems. First, a 20% crossover rate. Of course, we are all very fond of intention-to-treat analysis, but we all know that intention-to-treat analysis preserves the benefits of randomization, but sometimes carries problems, as probably was in this case. Also because it happens that 9% of the patients in the ultrafiltration group never received ultrafiltration, although they were assigned to ultrafiltration, and 30% of those in the ultrafiltration receive IV diuretics before the 96-hour assessment, even despite this 200 cc per hour fluid removal. And then there were no information on the changes in creatinine before. And we know that the transient changes in creatinine before randomization could be important. And then I would like to draw your attention to a further point, which did not come out in the paper, and not even in the editorial accompanying the paper. Here you have the figure 3S, which was published in the supplemental data in the New England Journal of Medicine. And your red bar here are showing the amount of urine output in the medical treatment group. The blue part of the bars shows the amount of fluid which was removed via ultrafiltration. And no surprise at all, as in the ultrafiltration group, the amount of fluid which was removed through the kidney decreased progressively for a very simple reason, and that was that the fluid was removed through the ultrafiltration device. And therefore, if you do an exercise, which we did, which was to plot the urine output versus the changes in serum creatinine, deriving the data from the figures that were present in the paper, what you see is that in the medical therapy group, there was a very nice inverse correlation with the spermal correlation coefficient close to 1 between urinary output and the increase in GFR and serum creatinine. No surprise, because by stimulating urine, you are increasing, with diuretics, you are increasing GFR and thereby creatinine excretion through the kidney, which was not, of course, seen in the ultrafiltration group, where there was still an inverse correlation which did not reach significance because urinary output was basically a little bit decrease, and therefore the component of GFR to the excretion of creatinine was completely lost. So my conclusion out of that is, with such a study design, this small increase in serum creatinine here was nothing else than what could be expected with the choice of such an endpoint. And in fact, to support this finding, if we look at other indexes of GFR, basically cystatin C, GFR, and glomerular filtration rate did not change significantly. So in conclusion, we have an eminent exponent of the NIHLBI here. The HF network trial are intended as phase two studies, that is hypothesis generating, and as such they are not meant to provide conclusive evidences and definitive answers, as Dr. Pitt just stated a few minutes ago. Thank you very much. I'll go back to my...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to respond to a couple of things. I don't know if this is all-inclusive, and I'll try to be brief. You used the term that it was not a balanced design. I'd like to state that it was a balanced design. I do concede that we had an unfortunate excess of patients with ischemia in one group that was not designed for, and is the obvious downside of smaller studies. And I do applaud the AVOID study going forward for a larger group. You did show some the imbalance in ischemia but I also, and I'm only doing this from memory, so I hope I'm not incorrect here, but I also believe that those with worsened renal function were actually in the pharmacologic therapy group. So I think you could point it in balance. It wasn't as large as the ischemic group, but I think we showed only those situations where the group was a little worse for ultrafiltration. It did not show those items where it was worse for the pharmacologic therapy group. And while crossovers were discussed, the number of crossovers to ultrafiltration were not, and to my remembrance, again, that was a very, very small number. In other words, people were not finding a need to bail out of pharmacologic therapy for the obvious therapy. I think it's worth stating that up until the CARES trial came out, what we've kind of heard from the prior studies is, gosh, this newer therapy is much better at getting volume off. That's actually probably the basis of all of the benefit in the UNLOAD trial, is that patients were able to be diuresed. Thank heavens, we were able to get the volume off. Now in this study, where the volume is off similarly in both groups, we're saying, oh dear, ultrafiltration didn't do so well because we got the volume off too well. So it either gets the volume off well and therefore is a benefit, or not. The other thing is that prior to this study, we kind of thought that ultrafiltration saves the kidney. It would be a much better therapy for getting volume off in a way that was safe enough to not harm renal tissue, and yet the creatinine goes up. I will grant you the cystatin did not, but it either is a therapy that gets off a lot of volume and saves the kidney, or it's not. And here, when pharmacologic therapy got volume off just as well, we're saying, well, gee, maybe the ultrafiltration was a little too fast. Again, the study was designed with the information that was known about doing ultrafiltration at the time. The study's been ongoing for a couple of years. We included sites that had done a lot of ultrafiltration. And if there are better ways to do it, then I applaud going forward with the future trials. But it remains to be shown then that better way of doing it is indeed effective and safe.
Yeah, but wouldn't you agree that you cannot compare ultrafiltration just applying a fixed rate of fluid removal and closing your eyes to what is going on in terms of volume, and compare this strategy with another strategy where you can use diuretic in a very careful way add different diuretics, check your strategy according to your urine output, and then use vasodilator and inotropes as needed, whereas in the other arms this was not allowed.
Okay, inotropes were allowed if they were necessary for bailout. The idea was to try to test a strategy of ultrafiltration, those things were allowed if the clinician felt that was necessary. And again, I'll go back to the fact it was designed by folks who really wanted to show, as you showed, Dr. Bart has been an advocate of ultrafiltration for years. The study was not designed in a way to try to make ultrafiltration fail. Michael?
So, very interesting comments. I guess a couple of things. I'm surprised to hear that not allowing inotropes to be given is now like stacking the deck, because as we know, inotropes increase mortality. I guess I would say the burden of proof is on ultrafiltration to show. The best interpretation you could possibly give of unload was caress was that it was neutral. I wouldn't interpret it that way, but in that case, you have an expensive, very resource intensive, not just in cost but in nursing, et cetera, therapy, and you didn't show in your discussion what I think is probably the most important slide from unload, which is not the primary endpoint but the post-discharge outcomes. In every outcome post-discharge we looked at, and I'm not talking about laboratory values, I mean clinical events, they trended and often quite remarkably against ultrafiltration. So I think the burden of proof is on ultrafiltration to show that it's better, and it's hard to find any variable in the CARES trial, any metric you can look at and say, in this way, ultrafiltration looks better than step pharmacologic care. And maybe it is because step pharmacologic care was so rigorous or excellent, and you could definitely say ultrafiltration could have been given in different ways and perhaps better, but I think the data are what they are.
But let me ask the panel, would the panel agree that the choice of this bivariate endpoint and the premature termination of the study were based on this change in serum creatinine was an unfortunate decision?
Based on the serum creatinine, it was based on the adverse events. The excess of death and the adverse events is what formulated that decision.
Yeah, but the adverse event was far higher than in all previous trials, including Dr. Barth's trial.
Important to remember that this was not a primary ultrafiltration population. This is an incredibly sick group who had congestion and worsening renal function. There was probably a lot of RV dysfunction, as you suggested, and again, the decision by the DSMB, which of course is an independent body designed to look objectively at the data and say should this trial go on, as Alice said, was not based on the creatinine change but on adverse events, and it also was I think 12 patients before the end or something, so it was not it was virtually complete.
Okay, Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just summarize a few sort of take homes that I see in the CARES trial. One, that the stepped pharmacological approach algorithm or strategy used in this trial in patients with ADHF and cardiorenal syndrome or worsening renal function worked pretty well. And I think that's a good addition to our fund of knowledge about treating these patients. Secondly, ultrafiltration used the way it was in this trial didn't turn out so well. And I think, I think you're correct in that that doesn't mean this is, sort of the definitive, indictment against ultrafiltration, but maybe we need to learn how to use it differently. For example, we use it in some patients, but never start at 200 mLs per hour. We start at 100 and work our way up slowly and probably would have taken those 12 pounds off over 4 days rather than 2 days. So I think it lends itself to additional study for ultrafiltration. But I was pretty impressed that the medical regimen here worked, and I think it does provide a roadmap to clinicians about how to diurese these patients.
There is a question from the audience. Dr. Haskell, please.
I have a couple of technical questions. First of all, how was the randomization done? Was it done centrally or was it
centrally?
Also,
web-based central randomization.
Okay. Yeah, there was a permuted block randomization which allows a fair randomization when you run multi-center studies.
And where were the sites of the catheters? Were they mostly femoral, central? Where did you put them? Because I'm very concerned about the difference in infection rate you had.
And that data exists, but I'm afraid I don't remember it off the top of my head. I was not an enroller, so
double lumen catheters are very hard to put peripherally, and I would guess they were mostly central or femoral, and I'm very concerned about the difference in infections. Mm-hmm. And I think that might have played
a role. I can't speak to every site. At least at our site, there are mostly jugular central lines or midline pick sort of insertion, so no femorals.
And I forgot my last question. Okay. Thank you. Oh, you did mention that maybe a couple of panelists that maybe this was too quick. I think it may be too slowly as well. I think some people need more rapid. And as a nephrologist, I mean, I would get more fluid off than 200 an hour if I needed it. I mean, obviously, I don't know what the pay. But I think you have to consider that the fluid removal may not. And with Lasix, you can get way more than 200 mLs an hour as well. So,
Patrick, do you want to add something on that? Oh, sorry.
Well, far from the... If I wish to compare such patients to chronic hemodialysis patients, we sometimes use sodium profiling in order to adapt ultrafiltration. And indeed, which may be interesting, will be for further study to use plasma volume variation profile, since it is indeed within the device, in order to adapt the ultrafiltration based on the achieved ultrafiltration rate, and in order to make the patient adapted to its general hemodynamic status.
John, you want to comment?
I think CARES is a pretty definitive outcome. I think it tells you that the simpler, less expensive, less complicated treatment for that patient population is preferred. So I think CARES is a great success. As I say, every study is positive. The issue is you've now got your patient on 500 milligrams of intravenous furosemide per day, full-dose aldosterone antagonist. You've maybe got them on some renal dose dopamine as well. You've started the metolazone, and they're still fluid overloaded. The kidneys are not doing so well. We think about the hypertonic saline and things like that. But do we actually need a randomized controlled trial when we're that far down the road? Or can you get to a point where you know that medical treatment has failed, there is no alternative, and does the alternative actually add anything meaningful to the end of the road? Because I think that's where we've kicked this technology to at the moment.
Yeah, I think I was about to go next. I'm David Gordon. I'm from NHLBI, so I was not involved with this trial at all, but I wouldn't purport to call myself a neutral party. One thing I just wanted to put to rest is this issue about stopping the study early. This study was stopped with 192 patients out of 200, or 188, so 12 short. There would have been, if the study had gone to its conclusion, there probably would have been roughly 6 patients randomized to each group. I think the coordinating center at Duke did a what-if calculation. What if everything went well for the people who were randomized to the ultrafiltration and everything went badly for the people who were randomized to the diuretic group? And it was basically impossible to get an outcome that was different from it was. So I think that's really that whole argument is a red herring. I would actually, in terms of the diuretic therapy being more aggressive than in usual studies, I think you know, without not being an expert in this at all, but my guess is that's the point, is that, you know, it's not, is that if you have a choice between, if you can get the same result or same or better result by pushing diuretics more, that's probably on the, you know, for the average patient, better than introducing an invasive device. And I would sort of turn it around and say, not that they use too aggressive an approach to diuretics in this study, but that maybe the approach to diuretics, that maybe the control in the other trials wasn't aggressive enough.
Mike, you want to comment on? You have a beautiful picture on one on the Jack paper on the dose response to diuretics in CHF patients.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that was a good comment. I think, you know, I think as was said already, that one of the important messages from CARES doesn't have anything to do with ultrafiltration per se, but that sort of traditional, careful, aggressive, what we call step pharmacologic care is actually a pretty effective mechanism. I don't think it, and just to be clear, I don't think the CARES trial kills all ultrafiltration for all patients in all scenarios. I think as tested in that particular patient population, it's hard to see it has any advantage. Now, to John's point, and I agree with him because I do this myself, there are always patients where you're desperate to try something and you've tried everything else and you're looking for something to try. And I still think it may have every clinical trial result is made up of some patients who do better with one, some patients who do worse, and it's the balance that we call efficacy and safety. So I don't think it's the death of ultrafiltration, but I think it's hard to look at the CARES results and say, for this particular patient population as a routine sort of intervention, this is something we should be doing.
It's a positive drug.
They're all positive.
Dr. Pitt, please, go ahead.
I think the NIH team should be congratulated on showing us the efficacy of proper diuretic dosage, and that's certainly going to be the standard. But I think I have to keep an open mind about the ultimate role of ultrafiltration. I don't think I know yet. I think we'll have to wait for the AVOID study and maybe further strategies, but certainly the onus is on ultrafiltration or the advocates of ultrafiltration to show that there's better outcomes. And I think that's the future, but certainly the diuretic part has been an excellent contribution, and now it's up to those advocates and investigators to show that one can do better, and I think there should be further trials, and we will have further data from AVOID and hopefully other trials.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments? Bob?
Well, just a couple. Even adding up all the number of patients that have been in these trials, it's still a relatively small database. I'd also reiterate that I'm struck, as others have said, by the adverse events, particularly things like sepsis and what sound like catheter and or heparin-related events. And this is a commercialized therapy, so there must be I'm sure hundreds, if not thousands, of patients have received around the world, so there must be a safety database or registry of adverse events. Certainly investigators or clinicians have the opportunity to report those at any time, and I think it'd be important to understand how the adverse events in this compare to what exists in those databases. A couple of minor things, the dobutamine and dopamine, one could say that dobutamine could be dangerous, but in the study it wasn't. So we know that when it's not, it can make cardiac output go up and renal blood flow go up, as can dopamine. So the question is, if there was a differential number of patients who got that on the medical arm versus the device arm, that could certainly offset that creatinine and raise questions of a background imbalance of therapies. But having said that, the onus is on these devices or any new therapy to show that it's not just inferior but certainly superior if there is increased cost or safety issue compared to standard of care. So I think this is a very important study. Avoid heart failure we'll probably add a lot more. But this is a very important study that raises the question of whether this is safe and is there something to offset the cost. And we don't see that yet, as best I can see.
So let me ask any of you, if you were to design another randomized clinical trial with ultrafiltration, what kind of endpoint would you choose?
Symptoms and death.
I think we need outcome trials. We need outcome trials, and if we can't show there's better outcomes, then the cost is not justified. But I think we have to do that, and that's the onus of future trials. But I think there is still lots of opportunity for clinical investigation, but for routine clinical use, one would have to have further evidence, I would think.
Mike, you were...
I think what Dr. Pitt said is, exactly right. The question now is, and this is what AVOID will address, is there, as a primary intervention, not as a last-ditch effort, is there an improvement in post-discharge outcomes? And if there is, that's great. That'll be a great advance. And if there's not, then I think it'd be hard to make a big argument for routine use in any situation.
Okay, I think we reached the end of the session. I would like to thank the audience for staying that late on Saturday evening. The web attendees and all the panels, we had a very lively discussion, and I hope we go home with some new ideas. Thank you very much.